The Wine Bowl of Freedom, Hector and the Women of Troy, Part 1. The queen is dead. Long live the king. A post-imperial union, a remnant agglomeration of transient nations of long settlement, a kingdom still a flavored husk of old Roman instinct and taste, is undergoing a lifestyle adjustment. The rest of the world, and perhaps especially its former imperial subjects, are joining in the mourning. Evidently, there is some power in the spirit of a monarch that arrests even the revolutionary heart. He's your king. Mind that your world-correcting ambition does not stray where there is betrayal. She was queen, and there is something in that human incarnation which calls to the spirit eager for equity and the dignity of the human, who feels the need to invest and even worship in a human face, some basis for our union, beyond the calculation of our reason, the stirrings of our philosophy, or the sentiment of our claims to property. It feels to such a spirit like a weakness, this need to mourn for a distant monarch, but honesty repels us from both the Soviet and the American, alternate paradigms of rational desecration and self-loathing. And so we mourn, as though our freedom were finally secondary, a thing precious but presumed, by the surety of the aging face on the money and the stamps. Not a celebrity, not an animal or tree, a planet in conjunction or a hero for equality. She is our king, and the fight for someone or something else without her can never truly be free. That, anyway, is how it seems.
Hos hoig ampiepon, tapon hectoros hippoda moio.
This is the last line of the Iliad. So did the men arrange the burial of Hector, tamer of horses. Homer's Iliad ends with a funeral. Elizabeth II may claim descent from Trojan royalty. This beloved horse fancier was perhaps the kinswoman of Homer's Hector. As we begin the memorializing of the monarch with her splendid funeral, the significance of her life and her reign for the new political and economic orders still birthing rough into new paradigms of anonymity and freedom. I ask about the funeral, the ritual over the body of Hector, with which Homer consummates the great tale of the Iliad. So did the poet commit to the memory of all Western culture the life of Hector of Ilium. Why? What is the meaning of Hector, tamer of horses? There are many of recent training whose first response would be to describe the phrase as formulaic. One should then have to spend the rest of your time explaining what that means. Suffice it to say that there is no evidence whatsoever in the copious and actual testimony of the ancient world to support the application of modern oral formulaic theory to the study of compositional technique in Homeric epic. One is therefore not obliged to involve oneself in its various circumlocutions and dodges of our question. Hector, tamer of horses, is a noun and epithet phrase, one of very many that occur in Homer's narrative. If you like, such phrases are the full melodic names of things, where the simple name without an epithet is a minimal form, like a nickname. Some things and people, like Hector, have several characteristic epithets each, usually with different metrical properties. It is unfortunate that several generations of critic have been trained to think of Homer as filling up his line with these phrases. It is truer to say that they complete a period where a period is understood as a dynamic, melodic, rhythmic, metrical unity, which would lack a certain balance or cadence without them. The repetition of noun and epithet phrases turns them into mantras. Their melodic shape and phonic richness are definitive of Homeric texture, and whatever their genesis, I argue in my work that they are choral rather than oral in nature, it must be allowed that the aural quality of repeated phrases, winged words and dawns rose-fingered, forms the single most distinctive feature of the Homeric aesthetic. It might seem absurd to say, but there are, after all, professional critics of Homer who do not see aesthetic but purely practical motives in the deployment of noun and epithet phrases in Homeric composing. It is as though the compositional art is hard work done under duress, like bricking up the wall of a dam. The epic meter becomes a taskmaster whose demands must be fulfilled before any picture painting or storytelling can start to be done. Perhaps it is permitted to whistle while you work. The disservice done to students by this approach cannot be measured. Description in terms of formulas is inclined to explain away rather than explain. The truth is that Homer's oratorio is an aesthetic event that engages the performer and the listener or reader at many levels and every level, all at once. Oral theory seems to leave this active, cognitive, synthetic engagement in the work an accident, at best, of the mechanics of its composition. In what follows, we purport to demonstrate the truth of this aesthetic event, so that speculation about oral technique, at least as it implies certain automatic constraints on the composer and subjects him to oralist psychoanalysis, may come to seem idle and irrelevant. Instead, we shall find Homer's aesthetic effects rooted in compositional choices and their elemental causes. The meaning of these noun and epithet phrases seems never to be opaque by intention, but their recurrent use in a patterned musical poem must tend to dull their semantic force. Frozen forms occur in every language, often inside rhythmic phrases that have become proverbial and therefore mantric, as for example in the English phrase, the quick and the dead, or what the fuck. It is likely that a melodic rhythmic superstructure like the dactylic hexameter, Homer's meter, which generates an articulated and idiosyncratic rhythmic microcosm, would be particularly inclined to freezing forms inside of rhythmic phrases. Homer, like Shakespeare and the rest of us, may not always be best aware of his etymologies, but apart from any diachronic context entirely within the world of the poems, the repetition of phrases, turning words into mantras, is the distinctive aesthetic fact. It is therefore the question of the quickening of his phrases that becomes most subtle in the close reading of Homer. In what way does one hear the word hippodamos, tamer of horses, in the last line of the Iliad? Does one hear it at all? Some translators do not bother to render it. Is it an adjective or a surname, a word or a snatch of song? Richard Sachs argues that the use of hippodamoio as an epithet of Hector in the last line, rather than the metrically equivalent androponoio, manslayer, involves a necessary allusion to the presence of Apollo, although the god is not mentioned, because earlier deployments of the horsebreaker epithet all seem to occur in a context where Apollo is present. It is Apollo who has preserved Hector's body in death, says Sachs, just as he often accompanied him in life. He suggests that the allusion to Apollo at a funeral would complete the narrative ring of the Iliad, which begins explicitly with Apollo's agency and the deaths of the Achaeans at the hands of the plague. To take this allusion One need not appeal to traditional associations occurring in some traditional mentality. The musical text has its own concrete constraints. If Homer is going to sing Hector the Breaker of Horses, but not Hector the Manslayer, in close oral proximity to the name of Apollo, whether he likes it or not, he has established an evocative connection in his audience, so that he cannot then sing the Horsebreaker alone without awakening the musical association. Their metrical equivalence is rather a red herring. It poses an issue only for oral theory, which is built around a strict economy required in the metrical arsenal to allow a composer to fill up his thought from a selection of phrases that also complete his hexameter lines, under pressure perhaps of an improvised performance. It ought to be obvious, however, that metrical equivalence in no way reduces the memorable differences in words' sounds and accentual melodies. The allusion to Apollo has a palpable reality, because we are dealing with the almost tactile power of phonic and musical memory. Of course, one need not agree with Sachs' interpreting of this evocation. A partial melody might just as well highlight the absence of the missing parts as the presence. It is altogether a strange evocation. Hector has already been cremated and buried. Sachs seems to forget that there is in fact no body left to preserve or even to see. Homer stretches his description in unusual ways to capture the condition of Hector in death. On the day that he died, for example, when he and Achilles danced their nightmare ring around Ilium, it was not just Apollo that left him, but the day itself, the fateful day which went off to Hades with the tipping of the heavenly scales. That's Book 22, 209-13. I do not understand what Homer meant by this strange saying, what it means for a day to leave you, but it is certainly effective in conjuring Hector's unspeakable solitude. Isolated from his family and city, bereft of God's help, deserted by the very day, he is left to stare alone upon the armed face of death. Between the knowledge of his doom and the moment of death, Hector is as alone as ever any mortal man. But he is also on the verge of another realm and gains a prophetic sight of this one. It's prophecy at 356-60 in 22. Now, after being recovered by his father from the horrors of Achilles' clutches and restored to the city, after the antiphonal dirges of the women who loved him, after the funeral pyre and the burial, what has he become? What being is brought to consciousness by the name and epithet assembled out of memory and bone? Has he a poetic identity, a poetic reality in word and song beyond his body's dissolution? Or rather, does not the power of the name and epithet phrase to conjure a presence contain within it a question, so that we can say with confidence that our opening question is also the poet's final question? What is in fact the reality of this Hector, evoked by the simple grandeur of Homer's characteristic summons in the trailing syllables of the Iliad, which survives and transcends his body's demise, not to say that of the poem itself? I must say I do not feel God's presence in the last line of the Iliad. I feel only the presence of Hector, tamer of horses. There were songs and even shrines dedicated to Helen and Achilles, but it may well have been Homer himself who heroized Hector. It is all too clear that Hector has not the stature of some of the other protagonists in the Iliad's world of gods and men, and yet Homer's telling of the story of Troy does not end with the restoration of Helen or the burning of Ilium, or the death of Achilles. It ends with the funeral of Hector. This event is preceded by the eulogies of three great ladies of Troy, Andromache, Hecuba, and Helen herself. These three can be seen as human and hence tragic counterparts of three goddesses in heaven, Athena, the virgin warrior, Androgynous, patroness of the arts, Hera, the queen, and Aphrodite, goddess of love. The relation of Hera to Hecuba and Aphrodite to Helen, as well as the tragic effluent of such associations, can easily enough be drawn. A human queen can lose everything she has, including her children, and everyone knows, but especially Helen, that sexual love down here can stink. The relation of Andromache to Athena is more subtle, however, and I shall reserve a discussion of this for later. But the palpable humanity of these women once again suggests, in the same breath that it denies, the witness and significance of the gods' presence at this funeral. One point of this triple identification is that we have here, in effect, an answer to the judgment of Paris. Indeed, such an exegesis may be the most concrete sort of proof available that Homer was at all cognizant of that myth. He does not himself tell it or mention it directly. Whereas in the prehistoric episode, Paris chose the gifts of Aphrodite over those of Hera and Athena, on behalf of all men, it would seem, here at the end of the Iliad, the three feminine figures give their blessing to his brother, a man whom they themselves find most attractive and choice-worthy. The relation of these brothers is something we shall explore. It is clear that Hector is he upon whom Homer's favor rests, and that Homer has designed to tell his story of Troy so as to place his mark upon this man. We must therefore ask, as the last words of the poem perhaps most poignantly ask, by their mere evocation, what is the enduring significance of Hector, tamer of horses? What makes this all-too-human death and its corpse a worthy sacrifice? This is a question that requires us to penetrate a surface feature, the final summoning phrase of the poem, in order to discover a deeper meaning. It has been observed, famously by Eric Auerbach in his essay on mimesis, that Homer's narrative designs no depths. It is all the manipulation, often dazzling, of surface and foreground. But those who make and promote this observation have perhaps not understood it properly. A surface and a foreground have, after all, only an analytic reality in relation to a background and a depth. To say that Homer is all surface is really equivalent to saying that he is all depth, unless one says that Homer is himself somehow unaware of the distinction. To a human mind, a text or other artwork that designedly presents a foreground must represent a more or less irresistible invitation to enter and to penetrate. Like the surface of Achilles' shield, Homer's text is engrossing and captivating on the literal level, a mirror of polished metal held up to the cosmos. But like the shield, it cannot point to itself. It is for the reader to recognize that the mirror is, in fact, a shield, and so to ask with reference to the world pictured there, whom or what is it protecting? And from what or whom? I am persuaded that Homer's text is an initiate's text. In the case of the Odyssey, it can sustain and richly sustain an analogical, allegorical, and an anagogical level. I am not as confident about the design of the Iliad, and in neither case do I claim yet to be an initiate. But in bringing to the foreground someone who is no longer there as a sensible being, the last words of the Iliad give the lie to any simplistic or reductionist approach to Homeric hermeneutics. The attentive reader is forced to penetrate the glittering surface just here, as Shakespeare's Hector himself unmasks the unknown knight towards the end of Troilus, although in the view of that poet, to find only rot beneath the beautiful armor. I am no initiate, but I can point the way to an especially revealing episode amongst the many episodes interwoven to form the great web of the Iliad. In Book 6, Diomedes has been raging across the plain, driving the Trojans back like a second Achilles, and Helenus the Trojan prophet approaches his brother Hector with a plan. Get the women of Troy to promise a sacrifice to Athena if she will only fend off the son of Tydeus from holy Ilium. Athena is a warrior god who is in fact backing Diomedes and the Achaeans, but she is also a woman and is to be propitiated by women in a feminine way. The finest robe in the stores of Ilium is to be placed upon her knees, and she is to be promised a sacrifice of 12 unsullied heifers. At a later moment, Hector will famously stand up to the soothsayer Polydamas, who has just witnessed a terrifying bird omen which counsels retreat.
Hesoionos aristos amunes tai peripatras.
One bird omen is best, says Hector, to defend our native land. But in this case, Helenus' advice is persuasive. Hector rallies the troops so effectively that the Argives think some immortal from the planetary heavens has come to help the Trojans. Be men, says Hector, remember your furious valor, while I go to Ilium and tell the old men who are counselors and our wives to make prayer to the divinities and to promise hecatombs. This is odd. Be men, he says to the Trojans, but he is himself their backbone, conspicuously capable, without God's help, of reversing the tide of battle, and he is going to absent himself from them at a crucial moment to go and talk to their wives. He mentions the old men first, perhaps out of embarrassment, for of course he never does go to see them. He says, be men, but he will not himself face Diomedes as a man. He would instead leave the army and ask the women of Troy to ask Athena to break the enemy's spear. One wonders if Hector is aware of a capitulation to female agency, and if so, does he embrace his emasculation? Is there something about the nature of Athena that demands it, or is there something about Hector that draws him, perhaps unawares, to the feminine? Why is he really going back into Ilium? Does he know? And off went Hector of the flashing helm. On both sides the black hide struck him on the ankles and the neck, the rim which ran outermost on his shield with its central navel. The image is slightly comic and a touch surreal. The warrior and the shield in retreat are a clumsily human grouping. As he runs away, viewed from behind, his back protected by the belly of the shield, one can almost hear the thuds against the neck and ankles, quiet above the din of battle. It is the hiddenness of Hector that is striking at this point. Homer's symbolic intentions in this episode become immediately apparent. No sooner does Hector enter within the Scaean gates, but he is accosted by the women of Troy, wives and daughters asking about their spouses and sons, their brothers and kin. Hector is their man among men, the protector of the city, the defender of their own. He is a man who fights for women. Where the best among the Achaeans fight over women, as trophies and as possessions, Hector fights for the women themselves. To be sure, in defending Andromache and their son, he can be seen to be fighting for his own. But a married man must also fight for a whole world of dignities and covenants, of family ties and right-hand clasps, for a world at peace which alone provides the necessary underpinnings of the institution of marriage. As Hector goes off into his mother's house, Homer seems to underscore this by describing, in an aside, the layout of Priam's palace. 50 chambers there were within it, of polished stone, where the royal sons and daughters pass the night with their spouses. The institution of marriage takes planning. It takes architecture. It is notable that Hector's first encounter in Ilium is not with his own mother or wife, but with the daughters and wives and mothers of Troy, who all claim him as their champion and all of whom he serves. Is a man who fights for a woman's man? Further out on the scale is Paris, whose service to woman has indeed made him womanish. It is perhaps telling that he builds his own house and bedchamber apart, as Homer later tells us. With the very best of craftsmen, Paris is a connoisseur in everything, to compete with the halls of Hector and Priam in the city's Acropolis. There is no question that he has innovated, at the very least, in the institution of marriage. Alexander's love for woman is also basic and intrinsic. One likes to think his love for Helen is not for a trophy or prize, as these are defined socially or politically, but for beauty itself. In her person, she is the very best of humankind, and Paris is a connoisseur. At least he has the capacity to recognize and to respond to the intrinsic value of her beauty. That this capacity gives him title to her, I do not go so far as to claim, but in removing her from her former situation, married to a son of Atreus, he had saved her from a position none of us would wish even upon the daughter of our enemy. When Hector rebuked and mocked him in Book 3 before all the troops, Paris responded by asking him not to cast the gifts of Aphrodite in his teeth. He is a beautiful man. Aphrodite is a goddess, and Paris, no less than Helen, is her beloved and her thrall. Priam, the polygamist, has institutionalized monogamy for his descendants in the architecture of his palace. As we shall see, Hector, a brother among weaklings, would institutionalize the warrior's code. In combining the monogamy with the warrior code, what have we here but a society attempting to Hellenize, if I may use an anachronism? But Ilium has something else contained within it. In Paris is expressed a desire for the higher things. His, figuratively, are the desires of the second estate, where the Achaeans would force themselves upon divine wisdom, for such may be seen to be the sense of Agamemnon's bedding of the priest's daughter, a daughter of Apollo who prefigures Cassandra. Paris can draw a defiant Helen to his bed in the Iliad scene of their reenactment with the evocative power of his word. That's in Book 3. Hector, however, is not Aphrodite's slave. His service to women is such as to set his masculinity all the more in relief. It ennobles it. We know what he is fighting for, as against the cynical trophyism and masculine eroticism of Achaean and Myrmidon soldiery on one side, and the effeminacy of Trojan Paris on the other, there is the valiance of Hector, the holder, husband and warrior. His very strength as a warrior is drawn from his posture toward the feminine, where he finds seemingly unquestioned motives and ends. His brand of masculinity is thereby set off in point of sympathy against the cold professionalism of the enemy. It is his need to reconnect with this source of his strength and energy that really sends him back to the women of Troy. If this is to read unconscious motives into Hector, I say we should not be afraid to tread these waters. The text will support the idea of a complex motivation that is at times hidden from the protagonist. A mission to propitiate Athena through the agency of women, a goddess who is herself an androgynous warrior, demands to be understood on many levels.